The Coast 89.7 is proud to present the latest edition of our radio documentary series produced with the financial support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. And now, the story of home with your host, Donnie Antle.
In this episode, we go back to the very beginning of Cape Breton's story. It begins with the Mi'kmaq people who lived here for thousands of years. They called this island Unamagi.
So I'd like to welcome you here to the Membertou Heritage Park. My name is Jeff Ward. I'm the general manager. I'd like to share a legend and a story with you today. And it's a legend that we... And a story that we tell a lot of people when they come here for workshops and when the kids come here at workshops. So it's a teaching that I like to pass on to the best of my ability. So long, long time ago, and one of the favorite things I love about this legend, it starts here, right here in Unamagi. Unamagi, if you don't know, is Cape Breton. And here in Membertou or Mabatou, in the original land of the Mi'kmaq people. A long, long time ago, there was a time where all our people come together and we lived on the shores here in Cape Breton. But it was really getting a really tough time. There was a drought happening. A lot of their gardens were getting destroyed. The rivers were getting dammed up. And it was getting very hard for our people to hunt, to the point that people were starving and their gardens were getting wrecked and a lot of bad things were happening. So we came together in our Maui Omi, our gathering, as we do 4 times a year, and we came together in the summertime at this particular time. And when they came together, they all start saying how tough it is and what was happening, because the giant beavers were destroying the land. Now, the beavers are not the size they were now. Back in the day, they were the size of grizzly bears. They were huge, huge grizzly bears, but they were beavers. And they were making these humongous dams, and they were destroying a lot of things, and having a really hard time for our people, to the point our people were starting to starve. So our people came together, and like I tell all the kids, and I'll ask the kids, what would you do in this situation? And the kids will talk about many different things of attacking the beavers. Well, they're very big. And the beavers would just kind of laugh at our bow and arrows and many other things. So, and it didn't help. No matter what we did, it didn't help. We tried to negotiate with them, whatever it may be, it didn't work. So they all got together, and I always ask the kids, what's the last thing that people tend to do? And they look around, and I said, what's the last thing that we do? And it's to pray. So they got together and they started to pray. And they prayed for help. They asked the Creator, Gusutuniskam, Abudunami, like, help me, help us, Creator, the best way you can. Ancestors, help us.
Before the Europeans arrived, life on Unamagi was dictated by the seasons. The people would live along the shore during the summer months, then they'd move inland as winter came. David Muse is a cultural guide at the Membertou Heritage Center.
So our people lived away the land, you know, that was their way of life, you know. We knew when to go fish, we knew when to go hunt, because that connection was always there. Okay, our families are hungry, okay, I'm going to go get a moose. Fall starts, so we would go out and look for the moose. But we had ability to talk to the moose. The moose was humble to our people. Yes, I'll gladly give up my life. But we always made the commitment to that moose that we wouldn't waste anything. We would not only take one moose. We wouldn't take 5, 6, 7, 10, whatever. We would take just enough. So when that moose ran out, the season ran out. So we were, you know, we let the moose be. But there was other animals that showed us how to come through. To say, for example, the frogs at night when they peep, if you hear that, the smelts are running. That told us our people were able to go out and do fishing, or fish for smelts. You know, and it was the seasons. Our people knew it. People dive. Our people dive down underneath the ocean to get these lobsters, bring them up. The ones that we weren't allowed to. Nope, you can't. Nope, it's not time yet. All right. Then they would do other things. They would gather berries. They would go get different medicines. You know, they had all the systems set up.
The Mi'kmaq Nation, which extended from present-day Nova Scotia to the Gaspé, was divided into 7 districts. Each district selected a representative who would speak for them in the Grand Council. The council would meet once or twice a year on a small island in the Bridore Lakes. Nowadays, we call this island Chapel Island. Back in those days, it was called Minigou, and it served as a sort of capital for the entire Mi'kmaq Nation. Jaime Batiste is an advisor to the modern-day Grand Council.
We have, you know, many districts within Mi'kmaq, 7 districts, and we're told that, you know, in Onamagi and in various places, that the Mi'kmaq would travel by canoe to the Minigou in Budladek, and that's where we would hold, you know, a week long of meetings, and this was a place not only where the people met, but there it was like a family gathering, family reunions, you know, they'd all in celebration of the various events. You know, we hold Pentecost very important, as well as the Feast of Saint Anne, and these are two of the cornerstones of the Mi'kmaq.
Our system of government is the oldest. The oldest one over here, you know, and they call that the Grand Council, you know. So the Grand Captains, the ones that read the wampum belts, and the ones that carried those ways, they still had all those ways.
Dan Christmas was an advisor to the Member Two First Nation before being appointed to Canada's Senate in October of 2016.
I've had a very close connection with the Grand Council. My father, who's now passed, used to be an executive member of the Grand Council. He used to be what's called a Badoose, the keeper of the treaties. My mom, who's still with us, she's 83, but right from the time she was a teenager, she was heavily involved with the Grand Council. Now, women have a role in the Grand Council, but it's a different role. And so quite often, they are the ones that make the decisions about leadership and about issues. And then they advise the captains or the grand chief or the grand captain and others about what decisions need to be made. So my mom has been involved with the Grand Council now for, you know, almost 60, 70 years. And she still goes very faithfully to Budladek, to Minigou, the island in Chapel Island. My mom is from Budladek. And we still go every year. She still participates in all the ceremonies. And what rings in my mind is all the laughter from people visiting her, and the stories and the humorous things that happen, no doubt, as things go along. But the Grand Council today, despite almost 400 years of colonization, and we're probably... Of all the indigenous peoples in Canada, we've probably experienced the longest period of colonization because people landed here on the East Coast first. But despite all that, I mean, our Grand Council still survives. We still honor and remember how Mi'kmaq people used to govern themselves and look after themselves in this land.
Each district always had leaders. The structure of the Mi'kmaq Nation was family-based and clan-based. They traveled with the season where the resources were most plentiful, but they always had family or clans, you know, that were often symbolized by animals. You know, if you look at the Dene clan, they're symbolized by a lobster. If you look at the Siliboy clan, they're symbolized by a bear. If you look at, you know, I don't like my clan, the Batiste clan got the weasel. I don't know how, out of all of them, we ended up on that one. I've never been happy about that, and I don't openly tell people we're part of the Weasel Clan, but I saw it in some books somewhere growing up, and I was like, oh, well, you know, no one likes to be called a weasel, but it's just the other clans have like their butterflies or bears or, you know, things like that, but or beavers, or, you know, we got left with the weasel, so not exactly something I'm happy about, but something that... and so we had family clans, and these family clans once a year, twice a year, met with other clan leaders, and we had each family had what were called keptins. at the time. And these Geptons would have, we took the word from the French, their highest commander was a captain. Mm-hmm. And so when we said, who's your captain? Or we said, this is our Gepton.
The abundant marine life off Cape Breton's shores soon attracted attention from across the sea. Europeans began coming here to fish the waters, and some even set up small temporary camps along the shores to ply the waters during fishing season. The first Europeans to settle permanently on Unamagi were the French. The Mi'kmaq enjoyed a close relationship with their new neighbors and helped them survive that first Cape Breton winter.
You know how they talk about in Thanksgiving and the Americans, they say, oh, the pilgrims and the natives got together and shared a Thanksgiving. And we're hearing more that that wasn't exactly the case in the United States. But in Canada, and especially Nova Scotia, you know, you had this Grand Chief member too in 1603 or early 1600s that met these French that had traveled. And one of the first things that we were told in one of the records is that the first group that arrived, most of them died off in the first winter. They didn't know how to treat the diseases there was. They didn't know where to get food, all of these things. And so the following year, Member Two took them under his wing, showed them the medicines, what medicines to eat. They showed them, you know, how to survive the harsh winters, how to clothe themselves, how to prepare for the winter, how to, you know, basically live in this area. And in turn, the French shared, you know, technologies and, you know, they shared different kind of, you know, they talked about music, they talked about stories, they talked about creation story. Of course, you know, back then there's a lot about spirituality and things like that. So, you know, really Member Two helped the French, and there was a bond created between the Mi'kmaq and the French.
It was at the meeting place at Minigou that Grand Chief Member Two converted to Catholicism, the main faith followed by the Mi'kmaq to this day.
Grand Chief Member Two was the first Mi'kmaq to be baptized in 1610. He did so as an alliance with the Vatican, because in the 1600s, the highest power in Europe in the Catholic states would not have been the king or queen. It would have been the Pope. All the laws were done with the Pope. So in 1610, when Member Two accepted Catholicism, it was an alliance with the highest power in Europe at the time, and that was in the 1600s.
When conflict between the French and English came to Cape Breton, the Mi'kmaq found themselves in between. They sided with their French allies. And when the English claimed victory and began to remove the French and the Acadians from their homes, the Mi'kmaq came to their neighbor's aid.
So there are Mi'kmaq people down in Louisiana. There are people down there that follow. They still have generations of people, children, that still, to this day, acknowledge our Mi'kmaq people because they're distant bloodline with us. So that means a lot to us. You know, and it means a lot to an Acadian. So if I see Acadian, I say, you have a long bloodline history with our people. Because not everybody got to stay. Not everybody was fortunate to stay there.
You know, one of the great stories that the lieutenant governor shared with me is that he comes from a family, Acadian family, and he told me that the only reason his family was able to stay when they were all being shipped out in 1755 is that the Mi'kmaq helped his family and hid his family so that, you know, many Acadians are here today because of the Mi'kmaq hiding them from the British ships or telling the British ships that, you know, you don't come into our communities and try to find people because, you know, this is our communities. And, you know, at that time, Mi'kmaq were still a considerable fighting force in the 18th century. So British soldiers wouldn't come into their communities trying to look for the French.
How they kept them, they hid them. Put them in canoes, or they would throw a kid to get in there. Because they always had a scouter to go ahead to see what was up there, one or two scouters to say, oh, okay, we're going to go back. You go back, you go tell them, get ready. So they only came through the village once to find them. But they went to every province. They went to, you know, to find all those Acadians. Didn't matter where you were, they went to look. If you had campments way up in the mountain or whatever, they go look for them. But our people knew the way to hide them.
Give me dead in my nets, Don Delio, no dear, need a much door.
And just as they opened their eyes, giant, very tall man walked. Now they describe this man as very tall, like 12 feet tall. He was so tall and he was in great shape. And as they looked at him, they recognized him, but they didn't quite know him. And they said, "Stranger, can you help us?" He says, "I'm no stranger. I'm Glooskap." And they were so happy. They were like, "Glooskap, can you help us? We're starving. Our people are starving. And what's happening here? Our gardens are being destroyed. A lot of things are happening. What can you do?" And Glooskap said, "Here, I'm going to share the food I have with you. This will get you through. I will go talk to these giant beavers. I will go negotiate with them and ask them not to be the way they are. They need to be respectful. They need to honor and share land in a good way. So, as I give you my food, I ask you to take care of one another and promise me you'll take care of one another." The people did, and they rejoiced and they had a feast. And Glooskap left from this area and he started tracking the beavers.
The next chapter of the Mi'kmaq story, unfortunately, is one of the darkest and most shameful periods in Canadian history.
The Grand Council was told, you know, you don't have legal authority, it was made up, and the government systematically got rid of our governing structure, our rights, our everything that we believed that we had as solemn promises from the king, from our treaties. And for many years, the Grand Council was told they didn't exist, and so we had Indian agents in our communities basically running how things go. And these Indian agents weren't even full-time workers. This was part-time. They got some money from the federal government, divvied it up amongst the few Mi'kmaq that were close to their communities. And
the Mi'kmaq found their traditional way of life under siege as they lost their autonomy and culture piece by piece. Here on Unamagi, they lost their traditional homes along the shoreline as they were moved to an inland piece of land that would become Membertou.
Gundawiktuk was actually the original location of Membertou back in the early 1900s. And even before that, there was there's evidence that Mi'kmaq people had resided along Sydney Harbour, called Elsibuk in our language. There was a settlement in North Sydney, and there was also a settlement here on the Sydney side, of the harbor. I think it was mostly seasonal in the beginning, primarily because I would say for fishing along Sydney River and probably for harvesting blueberries and cranberries in the area. But things changed around the 1900s when the steel plant came to Sydney. And people began to flock to Sydney. It was an economic boom. And of course, Mi'kmaq people were drawn to it as well. Because there were opportunities for work, there was opportunities for trade, and so the temporary seasonal location along Sydney Harbour, which I think is Gundawiktuk, King's Road Reserve, began to grow and began to populate. And you'll see from the late 1800s, by the time 1915 and 16, it grew to a sizable community. Because you have to remember, back in the 1800s, there wasn't very many Mi'kmaq people left in Nova Scotia or Atlantic Canada. But at the King's Road Reserve, they were saying there was over 100 people there. There was over 22 houses, and they lived well. They were prosperous because of the steel plant. And so the little tiny community that was along Sydney Harbour grew quite quickly and quite large.
If you read the actual case, what it says is they say things like, the Indians are clogging development. We retard progress. No one wants to be next to the unsightly Indians. And so they moved us.
Unfortunately, that was that really happened over maybe a 20-year period. When the steel plant boom happened, there was a number of residents that were near the King's Road Reserve that really objected to the community being there. And the most prominent person was a gentleman named Joseph A. Gillies. He was a prominent lawyer. He was a town clerk for the town of Sydney at the time, later became a member of parliament. And he really opposed the King's Road Reserve, and he went to great extents to have it removed. So when he was a town clerk, for instance, he got the town of Sydney at the time to pass a resolution asking the federal government to remove it. When he became a member of parliament, he actually changed the Federal Indian Act to allow the relocation to occur. And all during that period, he put a lot of pressure on the federal government. And to their credit, the federal government said it has to be a voluntary move. And so whenever the federal Indian agents at the time came to talk to the community said, no, this is our home, this is where we belong, and it's fine with us. And in fact, what they recommended to the federal government was they buy Joseph Gillies' property, and that it'll give them more room to expand. But finally, Gillies succeeded in being elected as a conservative member of parliament, and he succeeded in changing the Indian Act that lowered the population threshold to allow for a judicial review about whether or not to relocate the community. And I forget the exact number, but I think the threshold originally was something like 15,000 people in the municipality. I think he lowered it to about 10 or 12. Anyway, it was lowered low enough, so the town of Sydney, well, it became the city of Sydney by then, to apply for a judicial review. And so a judicial review was granted. The hearing took place in the fall of 1915, and the spring of 1916, decision was announced by the Exchequer Court of Canada that the King's Road Reserve, Oguntawictou, had to move.
The Mi'kmaq had their rights, lands, and culture taken away from them. Not at the barrel of a gun, but with the stroke of a pen. The courtrooms and legislative chambers became the battleground on which the Mi'kmaq found themselves, and they had to learn new ways to fight.
In 1928, our Grand Chief, Gabriel Sillaboy, went to court for trapping muskrats. And he told the courts, as well as his friends and experts that he brought on, that we had a treaty of 1752 from the king that said we had free liberty to hunt and fish whenever we wanted. And he was caught for trapping muskrats out of season over near Dundee. And what basically the court said at that time is that the treaties were no good, they didn't have any capacity, that there was never anything such as a grand council, and that we all of the things that we were told that we had these rights from the kings, they said they didn't exist.
So since the time the community was relocated here, 1926, and I would say to the turn of the century, to 2000, this community was pretty well forgotten. There was really no businesses, no industries here really to speak of. Any employment outside the community was very minimal. There was a few people that worked at the steel plant, but not very many. I really can't remember anyone working in the coal mines. There were a lot of tradespeople here in Membertou, so they did some contract work downtown. There was drywallers, there was plumbers, there were carpenters. They did that kind of work. But there was really no economy of its own here in Membertou.
Give me dead in my neck, Don Daddy, old no dear. Nigga, my stood, my wee Don
Give me dead. And the causeway, the beavers were in there, they were swimming. He said, "Beavers, I want to talk to you." And they laughed at him, and they slapped their tails in the water, and they laughed, and they kept on going, and they took up, and they went towards the other areas. So this, they kept on going, and they got to where Pictou would be now. There was another tribe, another group, another Mi'kmaq people, and they were going through the same things. So Glooskap took his food, shared his food with them, and told them the same thing, the last of the food he had left. And he jumped back, and he jumped in his canoe, and he followed the beavers up the river, up the strait, Northumberland Strait, to where he got to Parsborough area, where he walked Portage through to Parsborough area, Partridge Island, where he lived with his grandmother and his brother Martin. Well, when he got there, he was furious because the giant beavers had flooded that area, wrecked his gardens, and did all kinds of things in this area. He got so frustrated, he picked up stones and he threw them. He threw five large big stones. He created five islands. Of course, he missed the beavers each time, and they laughed, and he slapped their tail, and he took off.
Even in the depths of the legal abyss the Mi'kmaq found themselves in, there were still one or two bright spots. For example, the Mi'kmaq made one critical, yet underappreciated contribution to Canadian culture. You can see this contribution every Saturday night at your local hockey rink.
One of the things that the Mi'kmaq haven't been given enough credit for is we're one of the first societies to be seen playing a stick game on ice. This is in the earliest records, you know, we're one of the first societies to be able to say that we were playing this game on ice with a stick. And there's some dispute as to who invented hockey. You know, there's always going to be, you know, from my first memories, I think back 20 years ago, I can remember Ron McLean being in Windsor, Nova Scotia, where they say it's the birthplace of hockey, and saying, well, the Mi'kmaq have a claim to this game as well. And so, who invented the game of hockey? You know, there's many fathers, I'd say. But one of the things is that the Mi'kmaq were the first ones to perfect the art of creating a hockey stick. The current hockey stick that you see today with the curved edge at the end, that's all Mi'kmaq craftsmanship. In the 1800s, the Mi'kmaq crafters were the number one selling hockey sticks in Canada. The Mi'kmaq, actually, hockey stick. I remember it when seeing it when I was young, actually. It just, you know, there's a Mi'kmaq hockey stick. Wow. When I was playing hockey back in the day, never knowing the history. But the Mi'kmaq were the first ones to ever, like, make a living out of creating hockey sticks. And we talked to hockey historian David Carter, and he talks about how the Mi'kmaq were the first ones ever in any census in any place in Canada to list hockey stick making as a profession, as a business. And so that's something that the Mi'kmaq out in Sibenaigat, especially the Julian family and in Touro, they were known for their high craftsmanship. And if you look at the Pittsburgh Penguin logo, you'll see that the penguin with the curved hockey stick at the end, and David Carter says, you know, that's a Mi'kmaq stick, because the Mi'kmaq were the first ones to have that curved blade as opposed to a straight blade. The curve at the end of the Mi'kmaq hockey stick is what the Mi'kmaq were known for, and their curves and things like that. And so, you know, he says, if you look at the greatest player in hockey today, Sidney Crosby, his jersey has a Mi'kmaq hockey stick on it, and we were one of the first ones to perfect that art of the wooden hockey stick. Of course, today, hockey sticks are made out of everything from composite to aluminum to things like that. And so, but that actual makeup of the blade and things like that, that's all designed by the Mi'kmaq.
Unfortunately, those bright spots were few and far between. The Mi'kmaq had lost their culture, their rights, and their opportunities for economic development.
I think the turning point was when we hit rock bottom. So throughout the 80s, for instance, I had gone by then. The chief and council at the time tried its hand in building some new businesses. So I remember one was a wood harvesting business, a hardwood. And the second one was a manufacturing industry of involving irrigation pipe. And the hardwood business had a go of it. You know, the first few years were very successful, and then competition set in, and then we sort of got drowned out in the competition. But the irrigation pipe idea was a disaster. I think in the end, the community must have invested $1 million into the project and never sold one piece of pipe. And so it wasn't too long after that, and the community was literally bankrupt. We had a small operating budget from the federal government at the time for about $4 million. And we were, by that time, about $1 million in the hole, in deficit. And the community here was struggling to make payroll. They were struggling even to make social assistance payments. So that was 1994. And that's when I would say things hit rock bottom. And I think it was then the leadership here, Chief Terry Paul and others, decided enough was enough. We just can't live relying on the federal government anymore.
And yet, they persisted. It started with a reawakening, a new pride in who they were, where they'd come from. They started by reclaiming the culture that had been taken away by the residential school system.
The rebound comes from the residential school experience, where Mi'kmaq language and culture and history and tradition was all repressed. It was all children, like my parents and that generation, when they went to either the residential school in Shubenacadie or went to the Indian day schools in their own community, they were forbidden to speak their language, right? They didn't learn anything about their culture. And so that generation, you know, there was so much repression and oppression of who they are as Mi'kmaq.
It was John A. McDonald set up the residential school system. He wanted everybody to be Canadian. Well, what happened to Canada? Started dwindling out. Oh, take their people. Set up the school system. Oh, 1930s, 1800s, they would put them in those schools. So, oh, you got to be Canadian. We got to take your hair off. We got to take your language off. We got to make sure that you come out in our system. So that affected us.
And now those eras are over now. For the last 20, 30 years now. We've been free of those horrible experiences. And now young people are beginning to rediscover who they are. They're beginning to rediscover their music, their stories, their traditions. And there's a huge yearning to find out who they are as a Mi'kmaq. And that's what's happening in front of us, right before our eyes. The resurgence of dance, be it in powwows and in music, and the young people now are recording amazing music. You have books being published. You have movies being made. Videos. The Mi'kmaq are expressing themselves in all the modern ways. And it's amazing. I mean, it's quite often... I used to remember me going to high school. I'm going back to the 70s now, where I used to tell people it was like looking into a mirror and not seeing yourself, because there was no reflection, or there was no hint of being Mi'kmaq in the education system. You look through a history book, there wasn't really very much recognition of Mi'kmaq. And now, today, in 2018, you have schools now teaching Mi'kmaq language. You have universities teaching Mi'kmaq history and indigenous law, and it's just amazing.
There is a resurgence now that we have, you know, are able to practice our rights freely. You know, that has come with also practicing the rights and teaching to our children. You know, we want to make sure that their resource management is always important to the Mi'kmaq. So now we're reclaiming the rights of, like, hunting and fishing, but also ensuring that the next generation know that the responsibilities that come with these rights, and ensuring that the resource is there for generations to come.
I remember a couple of years ago here at Cape Breton University offered a free online course about Indigenous reconciliation. And it was just amazing the number of people who signed up to take that course. Not just Mi'kmaq, but non-Mi'kmaq as well. So, yeah, we're definitely living in a period of Mi'kmaq renaissance. It's a great time to be an author or an actor or a writer or a journalist. I mean, it's incredible how today the whole identity of Mi'kmaq now is everywhere. It's just so immensely gratifying.
More importantly, the Mi'kmaq began to win in the courtroom. In 1985, the treaty between the Mi'kmaq and the English Crown was finally recognized as a valid document. As Jaime explains, it was a long, tough fight, but one that was well worth the effort.
Since, you know, the validation of our treaties in 1985, prior to that, you know, we were entirely dependent on the government for everything, federal government, because they had taken away our resources, they had taken away our ability to sustain ourselves. So when we had the treaties validated, we could look to our treaties and say, here are all the things that we were promised yearly, and here are all the things that were supposed to go on. Now, in 1985, the government wasn't ready to hear that kind of things, and they said, oh, well, that's one court case. And, you know, we understand that James Simon can hunt, but not the rest of the Mi'kmaq. And so the Mi'kmaq thought that was ridiculous. You know, we didn't spend millions of dollars setting a precedent for one person. So, you know, one of the cool things our leadership did in 1990 with the Grand Council and Native Council, as well as the Mi'kmaq elected chiefs, we said, you know what, if that's your position, we're going hunting on this date. We're all going to be there. We're going to go get our moose in the highlands. If you don't believe that this right applies to us, come charge us. Sure enough, government took the bait, charged us, and we went back to court. But after a year of research, basically the Crown knew that they couldn't beat the Mi'kmaq evidence on our treaties and basically walked out of court.
The business we started at the time was getting reacquainted with the commercial fishery. And this was shortly after the Donald Marshall Jr. Fishing decision of 1999. And members took advantage of the court decision. We signed an agreement with the federal government, and we began building our commercial fishing fleet.
In 1999, the biggest case of all was the Donald Marshall Jr. case, which not only said that we had a right to fish, but we had a right to sell the fish that we caught. And so that brought the Mi'kmaq into the industry of being able to, you know, this multi-billion dollar industry in the Atlantic. Mi'kmaq are the only ones who have a right to be in that thing, not a privilege, not an, you know, access, not, you know, you can do it if the government allows. We have a right.
So initially we got into lobster, but later on we got heavily into snow crab and other species, and now we have a fleet of vessels, and our second biggest source of revenue here is commercial fishery.
The new century brought a new pride to the people of Unamagi, and with it came new opportunities. The seeds of a renaissance had been planted. Soon, they would bear fruit.
Give me dead in my nets, Don Delio, no dead.
So Glooskap jumped in his other canoe. He told his brother, come join me. We're going to go talk to them. I need your help. So brother jumped in. His grandmother stayed. And they started going through the valley way. And they got to the mouth of the St. John River. As they pulled in, because they saw the beavers go up that river, one had jumped out and attacked them. And he hit the canoe, knocking them over. And then the battle began back and forth, back and forth. They were paddling back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, to the point where one of the beavers was going to attack his brother Martin and almost took his life in the Glooskap had to make that decision and took his life of the beaver. That's why the shores are red there and its clay is red. And that's why that battle that happened there represents what today is called the Reversing Falls. So Glooskap got his brother back into the canoe and they kept on going up the river to talk to the other two. As he got to about almost to Fredericton area, one of his snowshoes had fallen out. Created Snowshoe Island. So he kept on going, kept going all the way up to the end of the St. John River, till one beaver died of exhaustion from running from him. So Glooskap went above him, because Glooskap had magical powers. He was very gifted. And he prayed over him, and he turned him into a big stone. And till this day, there's a big stone in the shape of a beaver. Then he started tracking. And he's coming back through New Brunswick. And he caught up to the third beaver. And he told him, I don't want to fight with you. I don't want to battle with you. But it was too late. The beaver attacked him. And a battle began back and forth, back and forth. They started battling back and forth and creating these lakes and creating these all these different lakes in New Brunswick. And it actually went right into Nova Scotia, down into Halifax area where there's a lot of lakes in that area too as well. And at the end of the battle, Glooskap finally held the beaver down and said, look, I don't want to harm you, I don't want to hurt you, because he had compassion. So he put his hands above him and he prayed over him, turned the beaver to the size they are now. He said, since you're not going to listen, you're only going to be this size. And from this day on, you'll only be this size. And he left him. That's why the beaver is the size it is today.
The Mi'kmaq Renaissance began with new economic growth. The validation of the treaties had opened new opportunities in some traditional means, and some not-so-traditional ways, too.
So fast forward, around 2000, 1999, around 2000, was the next turning point. We hired a CEO here, a former community member named Byrne Christmas, a corporate lawyer from Toronto. He came home, and he started the process of turning the community around. So his first task was to get the community out of debt, which he succeeded in finally in 1999-2000. I clearly remember that. I had come back to the community by then to assist Byrne and Chief Terry. And then we got into some commercial enterprises. And the first one was the gaming industry. The province wanted to set up a casino here in Sydney. And one of the potential threats of competition were First Nations opening their own casinos. So the province signed deals with First Nations, basically say, waive your right to open a casino and we'll allow you to operate legal VLTs. And so Member 2 got into that business, and VLTs, I say now, for the last 18 years, has been the single biggest source of revenue here for the community. After that, the ball just got rolling, and we got into tourism, we got into hospitality, we got into retail, we got into IT, we got into restaurant business, and anyway, we just grew and expanded from there. So by the time I left Member 2 again in 2016, our revenues were almost $60 million. And I would say 80% of that was self-generated, self-earned, and the other 20% was the federal government subsidies that we had at the beginning. So, and we went from employing 50 people, I would say, in 1999 to 2000. So now we're up to close to 600 people. And I would say half of that is from the community. The other half, I would say, is from the CBRM.
New opportunities led to a new confidence. For example, in 2018, a new Junior B team from Escassoni took to the ice for their inaugural season. It was the community that created the Escassoni Junior Eagles, as Jaime explains.
You know what? We were very fortunate. We had a team that, you know, we've taken down to the States to play in a weekend hockey tournament. Myself as well as Chief Leroy were part of the first group, and we took a team as weekend hockey tournaments. And as part of the tournament, you get to go down, play hockey, high caliber, as well as get to watch an NHL game. So we went to Pittsburgh, because me and Chief Leroy are both Pittsburgh fans. And we got our team, and first year we went, we only had 12 players. And said, you know, we lost the championship, and we were all gassed at the end of the game with our two lines, and said, you know what, next year we should bring back more. But so following year, we said we were going to Boston. We ended up winning it that year in like triple overtime, which is an amazing experience. And then we kept building on it. But when we had that, when we said we were going to go down to Nashville, we started raising money. And Chief Leroy came up with this concept called Catch the Joker, which is basically like your Chase the Ace. And, you know, we thought, okay, we'd make, you know, 100 here, maybe 1,000 here. We got very lucky in that no one drew the Joker. At two Jokers in a deck, and no one's drawing. So the pot went from like 5,000 to 10,000 and then 20,000. And then people really started catching on. Wow, there's a draw, and there's like 20 cards left, and there's 20,000, two jokers. And so it really built and built and built and built to the point where at one point, you know, we had paid for our entire trip. We had paid for everything that we needed. And so what do we do with, you know, should we stop going? No, we had to keep going. And when we started raising money for the community, we gave money to the local hockey teams, the local youth teams, and all of that kind of things. And then we did it again, and the joker wasn't caught. And so now we're making, you know, profit of $15,000 every week when we've already paid all for a thing. We got together as a team and said, you know, we need to find something that to give back to the community. And as part of that, we decided at the last, you know, thing is that we had about $40,000 or $50,000 in the surplus from this, and said, what can we do with that? And we all were hockey players. We all enjoyed hockey. And we said, what we can do for our community is purchase a Junior B team and have the surplus from our sales go to buying, supporting, and ensuring that we have a Junior B hockey team in our community. So we were very fortunate, but we're, you know, the leadership in our team, you know, a lot of people said, well, we could have pocketed that money and waited for next year, and we could have been, you know, waiting, you know, playing for the next 2 or 3 years free. But we decided that instead of doing that, we should give back to our community. And now, you know, the community, as well as the hockey team, are the major sponsors for our Junior B Eagles team. And it's been pretty successful. And, you know, the night we had the Bury the Hatchet event, we had a packed house, hundreds of people, and we were able to pull off a victory that night. So, you know, it was good. Did we pull off a victory that night? I can't even remember. It was a good game anyway. I don't remember.
A century of steel production left an ugly scar on Unamagi. When the time came to finally heal the wound left by the steel plant, the Mi'kmaq were there, ready to do their part.
Around 2010, I remember the federal government was very keen, and the provincial government, very keen on cleaning up the tar ponds. And by that time, partnership and consultation with First Nations became an issue. So if they were going to clean up the tar ponds, they had to talk to the First Nations. And of course, we're only a few kilometers away, so they came here. And so we began talking to the federal government. Well, yes, we definitely want this mess cleaned up, but we want to be involved in the employment and we want to be involved in some of the contracts. So at first things didn't go so smoothly, but eventually things finally got to the point where we got an agreement where the federal and provincial government agreed to set-asides, meaning that there would be dedicated contracts for First Nation companies in Cape Breton. And the two communities that took advantage of that was Eskazoni and Membertou. And there's a number of companies that were formed, mostly construction companies, and they began bidding on the contracts coming out from the tar ponds. And originally, there was a very low threshold of contracts. I think somewhere around $8 or $10 million of the whole project was supposed to be Mi'kmaq. In the end, we exceeded that. I think we went to about $40 or $50 million in the end. And the construction companies, both Neskasoni and Membertou, performed very well, exceeded expectations, quite often came under budget and in time, and some of our companies just proved, and had our own construction companies for many, many decades working in First Nations, but this was really the first time they proved themselves outside of their communities, and we're very pleased that we had a big role in the cleaning up of the tar ponds, and yes, we gained a lot of experience both in construction and business and how to do government contracts, so that was, I thought, a win-win-win for everybody.
There are challenges ahead, both for the Mi'kmaq and for the island as a whole. Cape Breton faces an uncertain future, but in the trials and triumphs of the people of Unamagi, there are lessons to be learned. Lessons that can be applied to create a prosperous future for all Cape Bretoners.
You know, one of the things that Engage Nova Scotia did as a provincial body I sit on, and they rated happiness. And, you know, most people rate, when they look at where you're from, you know, everything is about GDP or economy and things like that. But one of the things that they're more looking at is this quality of life survey and saying, you know, what is it that you enjoy? And when they did this quality of life survey nationally about what people enjoy, I think that there were three from Nova Scotia in the top, you know, 20. And Inverness County was in the top three. And so the thing with Cape Breton is that we have an abundance of beauty. We have a beautiful place. We live in a beautiful place, beautiful environment. You know, I really think that, you know, the Mi'kmaq, if the Mi'kmaq worked together with our local leadership, that we could bring so much to Cape Breton. But I feel like there's always that fear of, oh, well, the Mi'kmaq are getting this, or it's Membertou's getting this. But what people don't understand is when the Mi'kmaq are successful, just like Membertou, Sydney's successful. And when you have growth in a Mi'kmaq community, a lot of the times they're not just employing their community members, they're employing community members from everywhere. And so I think that the moment that, you know, our leadership of the five Mi'kmaq bands, as well as the leadership in our municipalities and MLAs get together and start realizing that the more that we build together, the better off we're going to be. And we see that in Member 2 with all of the things that are going now. You know, they brought back bowling to Sydney. And it's, as I understand, it's an amazing place. And, you know, you have the Member 2 Trade and Convention Center. But all of our communities have that potential, you know, whether it be Eskasoni, you know, we have, or Budladek, or, you know, all of our communities have potential. And I think that if we continue to do the things that respecting the environment, ensuring that, you know, the next seven generations have that environment, have the beauty of Cape Breton, and that, you know, we keep making this place a beautiful place to live and a beautiful place to grow up with, you know, the water, the lakes, the golf that we have. I mean, Cape Breton is becoming an attractive place to visit and to come and to live. And we're showing that, you know, the future of that, I feel, is reconciliation. We have to figure out at some point. They're currently negotiating all of the rights that you know, land rights and resource rights. And I think that when the quicker we get to a partnership between the Mi'kmaq and the provincial and federal leaders in this area, the more we can bring.
Well, the biggest challenge is the growing young population. Unlike the rest of Nova Scotia or even the rest of Cape Breton, the Mi'kmaq community is very young. So, for instance, in Eskasoni, they say they have a population around 4,000. They say 50% of that is under 20. So you have a growing, booming population. It's as if today that the Mi'kmaq are going through their boom, right? So what do you do with all those people? Not only in terms of jobs, not only in terms of creating economy, but also basic issues like housing and education and health. How do you keep up with that? So just a couple of weeks ago, Eskasoni announced that they built a new health center. I mean, they're trying to keep up with the population that's booming in their community. So that's the biggest issue, I would say. It can be a positive or it can be a negative. The negative, of course, is if there's no opportunities for those young people here in Cape Breton, they'll go down the road like everybody else. And Mi'kmaq have a much closer connection to their land and their waters and their peoples and their communities. So for them to go down the road, that's pretty well the last resort. The positive, of course, is that Cape Breton's population is slowly bleeding to death. From 1991 to 2016, the Cape Breton lost 30,000 people. That's according to the census. That's the equivalent of the city of Sydney disappearing over 25 years. We're losing Cape Bretoners at a rate of roughly 1,100 people a year. It's almost 100 people a month, right? But on the other side of the coin, you have Mi'kmaq people who are growing at a very fast rate. So the opportunity, I would say, on the positive side, is that if our five Mi'kmaq communities in this island begin to continue, like Member 2, to reestablish themselves in the economy, and I would say not only Member 2, I can see now Wekogomog near Waikagma is also now reestablishing itself in the economy. If the five Mi'kmaq communities in this island begin to grow this economy, then not only will it benefit our own young communities, but I would say, like Member 2, it'll rebuild the surrounding communities.
A special thanks to Jeff Ward and David Muse of the Member 2 Heritage Center, Jaime Batiste, and Senator Dan Christmas for their time. Wilalio. Next time on The Story of Home, we pay a visit to a French colony on the Atlantic called Ile Royale.
Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. We would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Radio Meters program for its financial support of this series.